This is China Business Cast, your guide to doing business in the wild, wild east. We're here to get detailed and get personal with experienced entrepreneurs making things happen in China. If you want to learn from on-the-ground accounts of how business actually gets done, this is the program for you. Hello and welcome to China Business Cast. I'm your host, JP. So I want to apologize for the long hiatuses between these episodes because I've just been swamped and I haven't been able to edit the podcasts. I've actually got quite a few in the queue. But recently I got some help with my podcast editing, so hopefully we'll be back to our bi-weekly schedule, publishing every other week. So today we have a great episode for you. The story of how two young American entrepreneurs based in Guangzhou, China, raised over $220,000 on Kickstarter. So without further ado, let's jump into it. Today's guests, Tim and Nick, are the founders of Lexell, a stone and steel watch brand that raised over $200,000 on Kickstarter. But like every overnight success, it was years in the making. They arrived in Guangzhou, China from the US in 2010 on a one-way flight looking for opportunities. Since then, they've taught English, worked on a wine distribution business, started The Elevator Life, a video blog about their experiences in life and business in China, and launched this Kickstarter project, among many other things. Today, we're here to learn about their experiences as young entrepreneurs in China and the story behind Lexell's Kickstarter success. Welcome to the show, Tim and Nick.
Thanks for having us, JP.
Yeah, thanks, man. Happy to be here. This is Nick.
This is Tim.
Awesome. I like to keep the interview pretty focused, so I have three specific goals for today's interview. So the first goal is to understand from a personal perspective, you know, your experiences as young entrepreneurs who came to China looking for opportunity. The second goal is to talk about some of the work and business experiences you had before starting Lexell, the stone and steel watch brand. And finally, we want to dig into all the work that went on behind the scenes, the blood, sweat, and tears, you know, to launch this successful Kickstarter project. Does that sound good to you?
Sounds great.
All right, excellent. So before we dig into the details, can you give us a little bit of background about your China story? You know, why and when did you first come to China?
Sure. We arrived in the autumn of 2010, August 2010, right after we both graduated from Gonzaga University in the States. Knew this was, you know, most opportunistic place to be at the time and still presently is, in our opinion. And knew we wanted to be here and start something on our own, or at least try to.
Okay, so you guys came here with, you know, a hungerness and eagerness and ambition. And basically, you didn't have any sort of like an uncle who was doing business in China or any kind of connections like that, right?
No. I studied abroad here for 6 months as a junior in university. And Tim and I had always planned to go out and do something after graduating. We just weren't sure where or what it was going to be. But after coming here, we just felt this was the place to be, no doubt.
Well, that's a pretty bold move. Can you take us back to that time, you know, autumn of 2010 when you just got, you know, landed in Guangzhou? Was it tough? Was it tough to get started? What was the first thing you did when you landed?
Super lost and confused and no idea what's going on. Yeah, I didn't speak any English or any Chinese. Couldn't use chopsticks. And I'm from a cold place, so southern China was way out of my element, to say the least. It was a crazy experience. It was so amazing just for personal development and personal growth. I definitely, if I were to go back and do it again, there's definitely things I would change about what we did. But moving to a place that was the other side of the world, the complete opposite of everything we were used to, was definitely a good move, in my opinion.
Cool. And what would you say, you know, was your first sort of opportunity that after, you know, being completely lost and not knowing the language, which must have been very tough, what was the first thing that made you think, hey, maybe this was the right move. We're kind of on the right track now.
I think we always felt like that. I think one of those characteristics that entrepreneurs have is just you're gonna make it. You know, the feeling that, hey, this was a good move. I know the main reason behind my move over here was to find an opportunity. And it wasn't the fact that when we got here and we were super lost that we didn't think there would be opportunity here. That was just getting comfortable with the life. But from day one, you could see there were so many opportunities here. Actually, our downfall in the first year or two was thinking too big. We tried some businesses that were definitely out of our reach at the time, past our experience up to that point, which, you know, is also another common entrepreneur downfall. But I don't think there really was a time where I was like, this was a good move. I really always thought it was because we were some of the only few entrepreneurs here that we knew in the city, and people and opportunities kept coming to us. So it really, from the beginning, seemed like it was a good move. But it did take us a while to find out what we actually should be working on.
Okay, cool. So what would you say was like one thing that when you came here, you know, that was really tough and somewhat unexpected? You probably expected the language and the culture shock and all of that. Was there anything that you found really tough to sort of adjust to that sort of blindsided you?
Yeah, this is Nick. For me, because I studied abroad here, I knew the culture and I knew the working capability of the language. But one of the biggest things absolutely for me was where Guangzhou is. I mean, even like the weather here and just how hot and humid it is. And it's a really, really warm place. And, you know, having to live here compared to where Tim and I are from, which, you know, temperate rainforest, Oregon, Washington, never gets too hot, never humid, never a lot of pollution, complete opposite of what it is in Guangzhou. So, oh my gosh, that was something we had to get used to. Like, this is not the easiest place to live growing up where we did.
Yeah, I'm in Shenzhen, so we're kind of in the same boat. I think Shenzhen's a little bit better.
Exactly. But... yeah, and you have the China Sea closer to you as well.
All that fresh air, oh baby.
Yeah, the good stuff, right? And here in Guangzhou, sometimes it's just, you know, you can literally see it's stagnant outside, you know, it's like there's just the floating pollution is just, you know, right outside your window. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, thanks very much for the background. I know the topic and the main focus of today is your new stone and steel watch brand and also the Kickstarter project. But before we get into that, can you kind of give us a segue of, you know, what kind of businesses and opportunities were you pursuing before you had the idea for Lexel, the stone and steel watch brand?
Yeah, we started with sourcing and trying to operate an e-commerce online business as well. That was really the first thing we jumped into. We knew, you know, e-commerce was a huge growing business opportunity, and sourcing is something that's always going to exist in Guangdong province, you know, where the factory of the world, if you will. And after, you know, learning to kind of work with factories and making a lot of mistakes and, you know, having to learn things the hard way, we kind of got into another opportunity that was exploding, still is, importing, which really was our first success. So we import Oregon and Washington wine to mainland China, and we started small with that, but last year, we got picked up by a very large distributor who we now represent exclusively. That again was, you know, more than 2 years in the making. We knew it was a good opportunity. We knew that we had good products and we knew we could sell it. It just, again, like everything, it takes time. That overnight success ideas are few and far between.
Yep, I definitely agree with that. Okay, very cool. So yeah, let's dig into the meat of today's discussion, which is, am I pronouncing it right? Is it Lexel?
Yes, sir, Lexel.
Lexel. Okay. So for Lexel, which is a watch that's made with steel and stone as a material, which is pretty unique and not something you see very often, how did you get the idea for this product?
Actually, it came just from the trend in natural resources. You know, wood's been exploding in every kind of product. And really our concentration on developing a product came from the explosion of Kickstarter. I love, there's been a comment in one of the forums that we're following recently from our good buddy Michael Park, and it was, if I'm graduating right now, where would all of you entrepreneurs recommend I go? And there are two places. It's either Silicon Valley and get a job at a tech startup, learn the ropes at a startup, so in a few years you can hop off and start your own. The second place would be Shenzhen, Southern China, for product development and developing products and getting them on crowdsourcing platforms, because it's absolutely exploding right now. And that's what we felt, you know, this is a place and there's something special happening right now. It's not just us. There's a lot of people finding success, developing products of their own, and it's truly an exciting time.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. And I understand, I mean, that's why I'm here as well. But why a stone and steel watch? You know, just from these guys, the young kids these days with their cell phones and not many people wearing watches and all of that. You know, why did you think that this was a cool thing to do?
Tim touched on it earlier, the trend in natural resources. It's exploding. It's huge. And we thought that the next step after wood would be stone. We hadn't seen anybody else approach it yet or successfully accomplish it yet. And we knew, you know, being strategically placed where we are here in China, that this is something that we would be able to do. It just, you know, take a lot of R&D and a lot of time to develop it correctly, which thankfully we were able to.
Let me jump in there again, too. It was a big challenge, too, because big companies have been trying to do stone watches, and we had heard that. So it was one of those things, like you said, being down here, we started, okay, let's see if we could maybe try and do that. They say it can't be done, but why not try? Another really, really thing that drew us into it was the amount of stones that are out there. So with launching our first line, that was really the first step, going, wow, this is awesome. We were able to do it and make fantastic looking watches. Amazing stones come from all over the world. They all have different stories, and we're hoping to integrate that into the brand going forward.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, so perfect. Let's dig into some of the details of that then. So you had this idea, and obviously your years of working in China and building relationships, you know, doing sourcing, that kind of gave you a little bit of an edge, right? So what did the execution plan look like once you had the idea?
The execution plan. Yeah.
So basically, like, what were you guys thinking? What kind of different areas of work and responsibility were you thinking about?
Yeah, so let me dive into that. Product development was the first thing that we had to tackle. It was the cutting of the stone. It couldn't be done at the time. So we sourced a lot of products, but this was one where there is no way to do it. And there was no way to approach. Like, there's no stone cutting factory. So we really just started by, you know, the cliche line of throwing everything on the wall and seeing what worked, because approaching factories that had no idea and never heard of what we were trying to do was really interesting. And so the first step was finding people that had the tools to be able to cut the stone. Not finding ones that did it, but finding people that had the capability. And then came the next speed bump of convincing them that they should actually try and that it was worth their time. We also ran into problems like stone quarries. They really deal in just big lump sums of stone, you know, like they're selling to construction sites and stuff like that. So right. Us to buy a few meters of stone was like, what? Why? That's like, you know, it's not very expensive. Why do you want to buy like this much of granite? You can't even do a countertop with that. So we were dealing a lot of the problems with just finding people to talk to and people to work with. That was by far the most difficult step. Coming up with a stone cutting process was really working with our design guys and then seeing if our stone cutter could come up with a process that could actually be transformed into full scale production. Because obviously we can't operate if it was going to take him 30 minutes to an hour just to cut one link.
Okay, so it sounds like finding the right people was the key to getting it off the ground.
Well, yeah,
how did you approach relationships? Right. How did you approach that? Was it through relationships that you've already built in your existing businesses? Was it using some smart, clever networking or outreach techniques?
Yeah, I'd say Tim hit it perfectly. It was a lot of on the ground research, going factory to factory. You can see in our Kickstarter video as well, people made a lot of attempts to do it. Factories we'd visit first, and then we'd go through the whole idea a few times until we found the ones who were actually able to do that. And again, the bigger companies weren't able to find success because they weren't here on the ground. I don't want to say it's impossible, but it's very unlikely to be able to do it, period, if you're not based here, at least temporarily, through the product development stage of your product, because it takes those days and those hours and the bus rides and the taxis, you know, to all these factories in the area of your product to be able to find the one that you're really going to want to work with. And again, this is just through experience of working with factories, knowing what the quality control line should like, seeing how clean it is, etc. All factors going to choosing the factory you want to work with.
Mm-hmm. So no shortcuts, just hitting the pavement and hard work.
Yeah, I mean, the model for success has never really changed. You have to get out there. You have to just grind it out. That's what it is every day until you're, you know, no shortcuts, pretty much. You don't want to sell yourself short. Just get exactly what you want to produce, get it made how you want it to be, and don't settle till it's as close to perfect as possible.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like just getting the product developed was a fairly challenging part of the process. Would you say that was the most challenging part of this product?
For sure, JP. I mean, going even into the project ourselves, we knew it would look fantastic because, like, we were holding the stones. Like, if we could put this stone on a watch, it would look really good. So if we were able to do that, we could sell watches, but we couldn't. And so definitely that was the biggest hurdle in the beginning. developing a process. It's actually patent pending now because no one had done it before, the actual stone cutting process. So we were obviously very ecstatic when we found the right pieces that were able to help us out. And it's not the people that could just do it. It was finding people that could do it that were actually willing to. Because of course, when you're able to cut the stone, that's the first part of the process. Then actually constructing the watch and dealing what is going to happen in the future with customer service and stuff like that, it just goes down the line. So finding people that we're comfortable working with is another thing that you really learn when you're here on the ground in China. I mean, a lot of people, and there's been a lot of problems on Kickstarter projects, is no experience in manufacturing, nothing really set up before. All of this success happens on Kickstarter. And that's why we're so thankful that we're set up good and we vetted the people that we're working with so we can really perform on the pledges that we gave to all those people on Kickstarter.
Yeah, definitely. How long was this entire process of, you know, having the idea to getting a prototype that you thought would work?
Most of last year, almost all of last year. To tell you the honest, it started, it was like, this would be really cool. Let's see if we can do it. And then we were working here, working there, trying to do it. But that's one of those things that you can't hurry, you know? You can't be like, hey, factory, I need this next week. They'll be like, okay, yeah, we'll try this. We'll get it to you in a week or two. And then those months build up. Even when you have a cutting process down, and then you're dealing with a watch factory, okay, how long until I get a sample? Well, the lead time is like 45 days. Okay, well, if I don't like that sample, let's get another one. That's going to add on to that as well. So it definitely, the time adds up, but it was well worth it.
Yeah, we had an ideal timeline, of course, all scheduled and planned out. But as you know, in China, you're at the mercy of the factory wanting to produce, you know, one sample when they have a much larger pending order that's bringing in revenue. Obviously, your prototype may get put behind that. So it's all about the patience game and working with the factory and, you know, finding the ones you want to work with.
Right. Okay. So yeah, that's good to get that insight into, you know, the work that went on behind the product. Because, you know, people just see in 30 days, they raised over $220,000. Wow, what an overnight success. But the true story is never quite like that.
Yeah, they didn't see the months and the trips and, you know, the hours and all the time that went in.
And all that baijiu you had to consume. No, I'm just kidding.
The cigarettes.
And the dirty factories and the gambes. Oh my gosh. Dude, who knew you would have to do so much to make a stone, a stone bezel and links for a watch?
Okay, so you had the product. You liked what you saw. It was a grueling process to get there. Was it all easy sailing from there?
No. When then came the fun of what, designing the campaign, the pitch, the video, the marketing, and then of course we had to do the launch.
Okay, so yeah, tell us a little bit about that. Obviously, you have a whole brand concept behind Lexell. How did you put that together?
Really just speaking truth, you know, the pitch that we gave on Kickstarter was really true, that we heard it couldn't be done, so let's try to do it kind of thing. And that's why it was kind of an easy pitch for us, but it was way more about the product, trying to get the product in front of people. And it was a lot of, when you're developing a Kickstarter campaign, talk to people, get it out there. I mean, I messaged basically everybody that I knew just with the picture of the product. This was before I launched a Kickstarter campaign. What do you think? And everyone had amazing reviews. They said, this is amazing, really cool looking watch. I've never seen anything like it. I'd actually want to see this in real life. And that's one of the things that we can't wait, is we're delivering these next month. And I think people are going to be really surprised when they see them. But it was a focus on the product and getting a lot of reviews back before the Kickstarter campaign so that we could really be confident with what we were going to launch. And another thing that people should do that are getting into a Kickstarter campaign is feedback. So the campaign we launched was definitely not the campaign that we started with. You can change things, obviously. I don't know if a lot of the listeners out there know anything about running the campaigns, but you can get up a live example of your campaign, and then you can share that link with others and get feedback, because I promise you, what you think is great and what you think is going to be on the money, probably you're missing big time pieces, or you've made mistakes here and there that don't really resonate with your audience. And so just sharing that with hundreds of people will give you a good view of, okay, how do I make this better? How can I make it more successful?
Right. Yeah, actually, I remember seeing your campaign before it was launched, because, you know, we're all members of the private community, the Dynamite Circle. And I saw the thread you posted there, and there was some fantastic feedback from that. What were some of the things that you originally thought, you know, were the key selling points, and what got changed and edited as you went through the pre-launch process?
With our selling, it was our pitch was too abstract, and we needed to focus more on the product. To us, obviously being so close to the product, we know the product extremely well. We're holding it in our hands, and so we try to add an extra pitch in there, an extra branding element, which was too abstract. And stepping back and showing all those people showed it. Okay, just focus on the product. Why do I want a stone watch? If I'm buying a stone watch, who is that person look like? And just having it more specific, more tailored to the people that are actually buying the watch. That's really what we got out of it. And like I said, it's just what you need to do. You got to get other people's eyes on the project, because first impression is everything. And people that are going to be watching your video, they're going to be buying or not buying based on that first impression. So getting as many of those first impressions as possible is the biggest key to success, I think. And your product, of course. Your product is the center of everything.
Yeah, that's real quick. What I just wanted to touch on was like it comes down to any type of sale or any type of promotion or marketing. You're confident in your product and you pitch it well. Odds are that you will be successful. But if the product is something you're kind of on the fence about, or maybe you felt you could have done better on, it's very, very important to make sure you do hold off on the promotion or the launch. And get the product to exactly where you want it to be, because you try and do it early and you're not quite satisfied, that will reflect in your product and even your confidence about the product. We're so confident in our watches and how they look and what we're delivering that we think that really shines through when we wear them or when we talk about them. You can see this is something we are very passionate about.
Sounds great. And so you have your product, you've gotten, pre-campaign launch feedback from experienced people and target audiences and business owners, and you sort of refine your message. Now it's time to put together the campaign and launch it. I know one of the most important things of Kickstarter is the video. How did you guys approach that?
I was out of town, actually. I was in the States handling wine business, so Tim.
Yeah, so I made the video. I actually started a conversation with, again, people that knew a lot about doing this kind of stuff, not necessarily Kickstarter, just knew about producing sales videos. One of the things too is if people out there that are listening are interested in doing Kickstarter, maybe they have one up, but they don't know if it's a good pitch or not, don't know who to talk to, feel free to shoot it over to us. We'll give a quick 5-10 minute feedback on it, because I know a lot of people might not know who to reach out to. But again, with the video, we looked at some really successful ones are totally amateur videos. It's important to realize who the Kickstarter community is. They're early adopters. They're people that like to connect not only with the product, but the product creator. And so if you come in with a totally professional video, some of that might be lost. But again, total professional video is fantastic for sales. It's fantastic, especially for making your product look amazing. And so that's really what we were looking at, is like, if we can go down two rows, we routes, we can go with a very professional video, spend a lot of money getting it done, or we can just go the amateur route. There wasn't any way, looking at the past Kickstarter campaigns, that really separated one goes, you can't be successful if you do this. So of course, trying to save money, we went the amateur route. And we tried to get FaceTime on camera to really give the company a face. And then our other thing with making the video was try to walk people through the process to really kind of give them a feeling of being a part of the team and really what was being created. Because what we realized was a lot of Kickstarters, they go, okay, I have this idea, and they try to say it was this long process, but you don't see anything. Okay, well, what was that process? If there's a process, you should show me. And so that's kind of the angle we took, was it really was a process to get this product built for all you guys. So let's take you through that process and show you how we did it. And we were also hoping doing that would give the customer confidence in our ability to actually fulfill their pledges. Because we were able to show them, hey, look, we know exactly the process that goes into building the product that you're seeing. And obviously getting the videos that we were with our faces on the video, we're there. And so I think that was really a leg up on the video that we were able to produce. But it was definitely amateur. It was all made in-house by us.
Well, I mean, the video production obviously is as you said, amateur, but I think it was a very good video. So we'll link over to that on the show notes for sure, so people can check it out as well. Okay, so you have the video and you have, the messaging that you want and the product Do you then launch the campaign and sit back and count money? I imagine not. So let's talk about what happens next.
Yeah, I'd really like to touch on when we launched. We all did it together, you know, everybody involved, and once we launched it, it was the blast of reaching out to, as Tim said, everybody we already reached out to before, followed up again, you know, about letting them know, hey, we're going to launch next week. So, you know, kind of prepping them a little bit. And then when the day came, it was up all night promoting, sharing, talking to, and anybody and everybody who would listen, you would reach out to, because that is the best way to get that initial push of exposure, which, you know, went really well for us.
So you guys were just staying up, messaging people on Facebook, tweeting people on Twitter, messaging people on Skype, just getting the word out there.
Yeah, JP, let me try and break it down for the listeners out there. We did some things fantastically well with our campaign, and we definitely made big time mistakes. And it's always funny as an entrepreneur, because whenever you're going into anything, you always feel like you know everything. Like you're like, okay, I'm doing this right. And it's funny to look back and you're like, nope, I didn't do it right. But it's also a cool feeling, because you know it's going to be better for the next time around. So I want to do that because it's really helpful for people listening. One thing that we did really right was reaching out to our personal networks. Mm-hmm. So each one of us, we reached out starting probably 3 weeks, 4 weeks before the campaign to every one of our contacts, Facebook lists, Skype lists, Twitter, you name it. This was the important part, not going, hey, I have a campaign, please support me. It was, check out this product I'm looking at. What do you think? A few weeks later was, hey, we are launching a campaign. Just to let you know, we're probably going to need your support sharing it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so just sharing it. No problem. Don't support. That's fine. And then we, on purpose, we did that 2 weeks before we were going to launch. So people thought we were going to launch a week before we actually did. And so we actually started getting people, when is it going up? When is it going up? And our plan was to launch the first 199, which was going to be the lowest that they were ever available. So we kind of used that as incentive for people to follow the launch and want to be there on day one. And so we did it again 2 days before the launch, and then we did it again the morning of the launch. And so that was with our personal network by far. I mean, we had very, very strong day the first day. And let's go to mistakes. The mistakes. We were super focused, I'm sure that the people listening now know, on the production of the product, getting it made. Kickstarter really came after that. We knew that's the channel and the way we were going to fund the project, but we definitely missed on reaching out to bloggers, reaching out to media beforehand. And that's so important for the middle of your campaign. So in the beginning, obviously your personal networks, they can take you a long way if you cultivate them the right way. But once those kind of trickle down, then you need to bring in traffic and eyes on the campaign from another way. And that's one way we missed. And why do we miss? Well, we only got the product. It took us so long to develop it. We got the product in hand, and we needed to launch our Kickstarter relatively quickly because of Chinese New Year. I mean, you know that all the well. Over here, everything dies during Chinese New Year.
Right.
So if we didn't launch the product when we did, if we waited, that would put us 2 to 3 months behind on fulfilling pledges. Because instead of being able to fulfill them before February, we were going to have to start production after February, which means April or May. And so we really didn't want to lose all of the beginning of 2014 in business. And so we did take that hit of not having all of the blog and media mentions set up before we launched. So that did severely hurt our numbers. We were ready to hit everybody up media-wise during the campaign. But again, the second biggest mistake that we made was the timing. Late November, early December is a time that it's not the greatest time to be selling a product that you can't deliver for Christmas. So that definitely hurt us as well, not only on the sales part, but on the media part. And I don't think a lot of people will realize that. So a lot of the blogs that do review products, a lot of the media that cover stories like ours, they're already booked for stories through those times. Because again, it's the biggest time for everyone that has a product anywhere on the internet to get featured. So it was really hard for us to get featured, even having such a great story, because of the timing. And a lot of the people would get back to us, be like, we'd love to cover you, but right now we just can't. We couldn't even get sponsored ads on most of the blogs. So I think the biggest things to come out with are reaching out to your personal network is huge, but also planning 4 months ahead to start reaching out and creating relations with bloggers if you really want your Kickstarter to be hitting that next level. For us, it was okay because we did make enough money to get the brand off the ground, and now we can go attack those blogs and media when our product is actually in hand and we're driving people to our site instead of Kickstarter. So those are my biggest takeaways and advice for people that are going to be doing the same thing.
Very good. Yeah, definitely very relevant advice. I know one of the things that Kickstarter does is like feature products. And I heard from previous, you know, friends who've done previous Kickstarter projects that just having that organic traffic within the Kickstarter community is pretty helpful as well. How did that play out for you guys?
Yeah, that's true. Being on that featured list on that front page, I'm assuming you're talking about, right? Or mm-hmm. That will be incredible for your product. We were there day one, and then we disappeared day two.
Yeah, we were the number one product on Popular within an hour of launching. We stayed there for the first 27 hours, I believe, number one on Popular. And all of a sudden, we were off the entire stream. We were, for some reason, removed, and we never made it back on, even being one of the, like, so I don't know if people know what Kickstarter works, but yeah, you have the mainstream, popular stream on the front page, and then you can go into the category and see popular per category. We were always near the top in our category, but never in the stream on the front. Don't ask me why. Did it severely hurt our Kickstarter campaign? Yeah, but we do have a few theories on why that happened. We weren't the only ones that it happened to. But yeah, it was kind of disappointing to see that. But I mean, you can't have everything, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I think the best point of everything that has been said thus far is what Tim was mentioning about what we learned from it, the timing, the reaching out, you know, because your personal network gives you your initial boost, you know, maybe that first 10, 20% push that you want. But it's a marathon, not a sprint. It's a 30, 45, 60 day campaign. And if you do well that first day, good job. But it is, you know, it is not something that you just kind of, okay, well, now it's over. No, it's, you know, it's a full time kind of duty that you have to do for, you know, more than a month is how long we were doing it.
So how much, what was the trajectory like? So the initial push was great and it got you to, did it get you to 100,000?
Our first 12 hours, we did 50,000, and I think after day one, it was 60 or 70, and we reached 100,000 in 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, our trajectory, was off the charts, trending towards seven-figure amounts, which we knew were, you know, extremely inflated because it was a huge initial push, but we thought that we were going to end up much higher than we did, but again, this was just, there were variables we didn't anticipate to happen that we now know and can now handle appropriately for our next launch.
Cool. So if you were to do it over again, it sounds like the right timing is very important. Reaching out to media ahead of time and sort of lining that up is very important. I know one of our friends also launched a Kickstarter campaign over at Manal with their travel backpack. Those guys actually visited the Kickstarter headquarters, right? Like mm-hmm. they chilled out and had some, I'm assuming, some drinks with the Kickstarter guys and talked about the project they were working on. I guess, like, is that part of it as well? Just like understanding and building a relationship with Kickstarter so you know what's going on and there's an open line of communication?
I think there's two things to decide what you want to do going into Kickstarter, okay? For us, we wanted to get a business up, right? Kickstarter was the means to doing that. So there's two things that you want to consider before kind of making the decisions on how you're going to do it. Is Kickstarter the end? Like, is your goal to raise the most on Kickstarter? Or is it to raise the money that you need to get the business off the ground? For us, obviously, with launching way before kind of we were prepared with media or we'd put it out there to all the outlets, it was to get the business off the ground as soon as we could. And that was exciting to us. That was the goal. If you're trying to destroy Kickstarter and, you know, really rank high for how much money you're going to bring in, then, yeah, there's definitely a system that you can go through. First of all, of course, it had an amazing product, but the Manal guys, they did a fantastic job of promoting their campaign for months and months and months and months before they launched. It was dialed down to a science to really get them as much funding as possible and drive them forward, which was fantastic. And so they're a great example of how to reach out and develop relationships with reporters, how to reach out and develop a relationship with Kickstarter. So yeah, I think, you know, those are two things that you need to take into consideration. Another consideration for a lot of people is if they have a successful product, they want to be selling on their website as soon as possible, because, you know, you're not losing all the percent that Kickstarter takes, and you're making more money because of a higher price point. So those are the two things to consider when you're kind of building towards your campaign.
Very well put. Very well put. So we talked about some of the mistakes that you feel like you made during the process. And obviously, you know, the first time you do something, it's never perfect. Is there anything else you would have done differently?
I don't know about differently. If I was in that same position now, if I could go back, of course, I would do everything differently, not only with Kickstarter, just with setting the product up and, you know, the branding. But I don't know. I mean, the biggest thing to realize, too, is we still don't know why we weren't on the front page. So I would love it if we could give a reason for that to the community, because we weren't the only ones. We still don't know the equation to being featured. And so that's still the random idea in the air that we don't know. Reaching out to Kickstarter, you know, they have some kind of equation. That's just what they keep telling you, because we reached out to people at Kickstarter that we knew. So if anyone finds out how to nail themselves on the front page, which there's only a few companies that have found out how to do that, then you're golden. But as per se mistakes that we made that we would do differently if we were in the same position, not really, other than what we know now.
Yeah. Fair enough. Yeah, so you guys run a blog over at theelevatorlife.com, and we'll link up to that in the show notes as well. And you talk a lot about your personal experiences and business opportunities and business experiences in China. You said 2014 is the year of product development. I was checking out one of your recent videos. What do you guys mean by that?
This year, it's just such a new opportunity, and it's growing so quickly. Crowdfunding, you can now see it for not only products, people do it for inspiring trips, or, you know, to get like a certain education. You know, there's crowdfunding now just kind of influencing every part of your life. I mean, there's related to every part of your life, whether it's personal, casual, business, what have you. And we just see this as like the opportunity of this year for entrepreneurs who, you know, like us, started small, didn't have a lot to, you know, didn't come over with a lot, just a lot of ambition and ideas and willing to learn. And I really see this as such a viable opportunity for early stage entrepreneurs to be able to see if their idea will work for a relatively low amount of capital to start, compared to before when you had to get hundreds of thousands of inventory and then get into shops or retail shops and et cetera, et cetera. That's not the case anymore. You know, you can now make your product, develop your product, get it in front of eyes and an audience and see and really, you know, validate your idea or not, depending on, you know, if you'll be successful.
Well put. Yeah. Makes a lot of sense.
JP, I mean, you know, from running an e-commerce store, trying to get a brand off the ground from scratch is difficult.
Oh yeah.
It's yep. One of the hardest things that I can imagine out there to do. And that's what is so crazy about crowdfunding is you get two things. You get obviously the money to develop the product, but then you get widespread promotion of what you're doing and feedback. So right away, you're going to know if it's going to work. You're going to have the capital to get it off the ground, and you're going to have already a big time base of consumers that either buy your product or know about your product. And so it's a perfect storm for product development. So say product development was huge and has always been huge here in Southern China, but now it's at a whole new level for entrepreneurs. You can come here and get it's totally viable. The system is set up, and that's why we're so excited about it.
Yeah, it's kind of like, you know, launching a rocket. The hardest part is getting it sort of out of Earth's atmosphere and into orbit, right? Kickstarter is kind of like that rocket boost that gives you that initial push. That's the hardest part of, you know, launching something.
Exactly. The problem that Kickstarter is having too is with so many people that are launching products that can't do it. There's another article recently on Fast Company about how people can't fulfill their pledges. And so that's another thing that we want to hopefully get people to realize, that it's way more than just putting it up on Kickstarter. So it doesn't ruin it for a lot of people and people lose faith in the platform. just putting it up on Kickstarter is the first step, is one of the steps. But make sure that you have the experience, the understanding, and the ability to fulfill your pledges.
Yep. And where are you guys with that now in terms of, you know, Lexell, the watches? Everything is going well with production and fulfillment?
So we are supposed to deliver in February. Okay, mm-hmm. That's when we told everyone that they're finished. I'm actually going for the final QC check after this call. In about an hour, I'll be heading down to Shenzhen where you're at. And so, yeah, all of our watches were going to be delivered in February, except for maybe one of the women's. But that was a stretch goal at the very end of the campaign. And so our customers will understand, because we had to go through the whole new mold process, sample process, and then production. But we're still actually hoping to get that out in February as well. But like I said, the only reason we were able to do this is we knew our timetable. We had already set up shipping, who we were going to ship to, how we're going to ship to, who's our 3PL in different countries. So, I mean, there is so much that goes into the fulfillment process that people don't really understand.
Yeah, definitely doing the upfront work, the legwork, and, you know, the 1 year of preparation puts you guys in an awesome spot. So, yeah, glad to hear that, you know, the fulfillment is going well. Yeah, I have an interesting question. So you guys said that Kickstarter was the way to get the business off the ground. So what next for Lexell in terms of, you know, pushing the brand forward?
Okay, so pre-sales have been going well, but obviously we need product in people's hands. Social media is going to be our biggest avenue by far, you know, spreading the brand, spreading our messages as far as it can take. Of course, it's free, but our second biggest thing that we'll be targeting with paid stuff is Facebook ads and Facebook advertising, sponsored posts, etc. Because again, we've talked to a lot of other people selling stuff online, building brands, and social media is definitely the route you want to go. We've definitely started doing that heavily in this last month, even though we don't have product and even though we're still in pre-sale phase. Going forward, it's going to be a lot of that. It's going to be affiliates. It's going to be getting into retail and on other sites that are selling similar kind of products. And so we've got a whole strategy laid out of how we're going to expand our presence. So yeah, it's definitely just the beginning.
Great. Well, I mean, looking forward to keeping up with you guys and see where you take the brand.
Thanks, buddy.
Cheers, man.
Cool. Okay, so that was a great discussion about Lexell, the brand, and, you know, the successful Kickstarter campaign and all the work that went on behind it. So thank you guys for sharing. Now, before we wrap up, I'd love to hear a bit more about what you're currently excited and working on. I guess I know you guys are hardcore entrepreneurs and you always have different projects going on. So can you tell us a little bit more about what you're excited about right now?
Yeah, absolutely. One of our focuses is Enter China, which is our private entrepreneurship forum for doing business in China. And we're just really excited this year to grow it and, you know, make sure that we benefit as many entrepreneurs as possible who want to get involved in China. You want to talk a little bit about it?
Yeah, JP. So a little background, Enter China was developed because of the Elevator Life, our personal blog, and how many responses we would get from people just basic questions on China, people trying to test the water to see really if it would be for them. So instead of just emailing everyone individually, we decided, okay, well, there's that much people that are interested in doing it. Let's create a forum where we can all get together, answer each other's questions, and try and help each other out. So that was really the beta last year for about the last 6 months, talking to the members inside. So basically, it's just been a forum. The last year was just a forum. Being able to talk to the members and everything else that they're really concerned with and where they could use help has allowed us to gain really interesting insight of where we can help people. So we're really excited. In February, we're going to be totally relaunching it. Actually, we're working with Sean Ogle from Location 180. And really, we're going to make it totally hands-on. We want to give people actual modules of how to do specific businesses in China. For example, Kickstarter and product development will be one. And sourcing and importing will be others. And actually just moving and making the transition to China will be another. And then, of course, inside, once you're already inside, you have hands on all these different products. We're going to have case studies and we're going to have actually experts in the forums that you can interact with as well. The goal being to give people the support that they need to be able to do this, to do what we did back in 2010. And hopefully avoid all the mishaps that we did along the way in the last 4 years. because you and I know being entrepreneurs, there's nothing more important than having people around you that have been there and have done what you wanted to do. I think also the last big time benefit of Inner China is really figuring out if this is for you or not. Just with being a part of the forum and being a part of the products here, you're going to know whether doing something like this product development is for you. If it's not, doing and living and making the move to China, is that for you or not? Being able to talk to other people that have done it and really hear candid responses will hopefully, if it's not for you, save you maybe a year or 2 years of time thinking about making the move, actually making the move and not liking it. So there's a ton of aspects that are a part of that group that we're doing there. Premise being to help as many people as possible kind of do what we've done and bring them all together in one place.
Sounds like a fantastic project. We'll definitely link up to the show notes to both theelevatorlife.com and interchina.co.
Thanks a lot, buddy.
Sounds good.
So before we finally take off, can you leave the audience with one final piece of advice and let them know what the best way is to connect with you?
Take action. Take the first step. That's one thing we do a lot with or deal a lot with in consulting is people kind of teetering back and forth, yes or no, yes and no. You know, before you know it, you've spent so much time going back and forth, but you have nothing to show for it. You know, the hardest part is the start, and I think a lot of people really just need to take action, take that first step, and then, you know, kind of learn from there and keep moving.
Educate yourself. We're both big-time readers. I think that's one of the things that you have to balance as being an entrepreneur. It can be super easy to go either way. You can read too much, read too many blogs, read too much information and not do anything, or you could get sucked into your business and really you can't see beyond really what you're doing day to day. And those are both mistakes. You really got to make sure that you're constantly learning, constantly reading, but also make sure that that doesn't take over the actionable steps that you're taking. And that's one thing that we always got to check ourselves on. And that goes for whether you're starting, whether you've been doing it for years or whether you've been doing it for 10 years. So that's my advice.
Fantastic. Is there one specific piece of thing that you've read recently that you'd like to recommend?
The Slight Edge. I always recommend that. It's one of the first things I read back in the beginning, and I think it's great for anyone starting out, even if you haven't read it. It's one of the things that talks about the basics of just being a really successful individual.
Fantastic. Okay, and what's the best way for the audience to connect with you if they want to follow up and, you know, ask questions?
The Elevator Life, obviously. Feel free to email us on there, Twitter, Facebook. We have all that stuff linked to our blog. And then, of course, Enter China is another way to gain, you know, direct access to us, you know, for consulting, working, you know, just direct questions you have about doing business in China. So, you know, you have quite a few avenues to reach us.
Okay, so we'll link up to all of those in the show notes as well. Thanks very much for sharing your experience with us today, Nick and Tim. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of China Business Cast. Head over to chinabusinesscast.com and enter your email to get on the list. I'll announce guests before I interview them, and you'll get a chance to submit your question for the show. Till next time, thank you for listening.